Hey there, Curious KDO listeners. It's your host, KDO, back with another thought-provoking episode that I know you're going to love. Today, we're diving deep into a book that's been making a lot of waves and sparking a lot of conversation around the role that technology and the internet and access to the internet has on young minds. The book is called The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt. Now, let me tell you something you may not know. I actually had the opportunity to meet the author at a Wall Street Journal event earlier this year after watching him speak. And let me just say, he made a huge impression on me. We chatted a bit about how young talent coming out of college is very different than other generations and how they seem to be struggling with uncertainty, which is leading to this idea of anxiety. And it's really this transition from such a structured world where everything is known and spelled out to the workplace, which is a lot more random, undefined, and needs to have kind of that self-evolution of what that looks like. So, you know, it's obviously not all the generation, but it's enough. And he wrote an entire book about this called The Coddling of the American Mind, around feedback, around what it means when you don't have any kind of pressure or challenge growing up. And so we had a really great chat about that because I had read that book. And what I wanted to do was take that evolution of what he uncovered in that book and talk about his latest book, The Anxious Generation, and the evolution of what technology and the role that it has played in the minds of people that are coming out of high school, coming out of college, entering the workplace. And what he does is he explores why things like anxiety levels have skyrocketed in recent years, particularly among young people, and what we can do about it. You know, what are some things that are actionable and tangible that people can do? So this episode is all around, you know, some key highlights and learnings from the book, the steps that you can take, things that you can think about. I'll try to keep it fun and interesting, but it is something that a lot of people are thinking about now as it relates to technology and as it relates to the role of technology is playing on how younger generations are coming up in society. So the first key learning is really around the role of social media and its links to anxiety. So that was a theme throughout the book. So let's talk about that. And it really relates to this idea of social media. So Jonathan lays out some eye-opening stats here. Did you know that anxiety rates among teens began to spike around 2012? Right around the time social media use became widespread. Wonder if that's a coincidence. Probably not. So he shares a quote that really stood out to me, and this is the quote. Social media has turned into a giant social comparison engine, constantly telling young people where they stand relative to their peers in ways that are often unrealistic and unattainable. And I think that's a big part of the problem. You know, when I was coming up in these critical years, and I'm almost 47, so it gives you an idea, you know, we had kids at school who kind of set some trends. Maybe they had a little bit more money than some others, but not much. We were all kind of low middle class, right outside of Detroit. And then we had Hollywood celebrities, like in Teen Beat magazine and people that you would look at. But we never knew that that was like our world. It was just something that Hollywood was doing and maybe you aspired to it. So you would think about it, but not all the time. It wouldn't be in your face. And now your comparison is literally everyone, everywhere. And a lot of times these young folks are expected to match them designer outfit to designer outfit, crazy experience to crazy experience. It's just not realistic. And so what was a small community with social media, everything is the community. And what that means is everything is up for comparison. Where do you stack up? And we all know social media can be this double-edged sword. On the one hand, it connects us. On the other, it fuels for a lot of kids this insecurity and anxiety. And the author suggests that one step we can take is be more mindful of how much time we're spending online and to focus more on real-world connections. And that's a big gap that we see with a lot of folks, is this idea of connecting in person on the phone almost is like speaking a foreign language now, as opposed to sending a text or an email or a Slack, you know, to somebody. And this idea of not having real world connections is creating huge deficits. And so he points out that studies that show that people who limit their social media to just 30 minutes a day experience significant mental health improvements. So let's face it, you know, social media isn't going anywhere, but we can control how we interact with it. And so I would start by setting some boundaries and encourage the young people in your life to do the same. And for me, I set a timer on my social media of what I'm allowed to do per day. And every couple of months, I continue to reduce it by 10 minutes. And so for me, I'm conscious of it, and I like having the reminder pop up that's like, hey, you've been on here for your limit today. Go find something else to do. And I'll also tell you a secret. If you look at the social media profiles of people working in digital media or digital marketing, which is something that I and my team are responsible for, it's probably limited to 1 to 2 platforms. You only have a few required connections, and it's most likely completely private. And one of the reasons for that is because we know all of the things that these digital companies can see and do and influence. And the more time you spend on there, the higher profile of a commodity you are. I heard somebody say once that social media is not the product. You are the product. And so what they're doing is selling you. They're selling your time to advertisers, your product that's being sold by social media companies. That's why you get to use it for free. And I'll tell you this, I got made fun of for the 40 followers on my private Instagram by some younger folks. They said, you only have 40 followers. How is that possible? And I said, because I actually know who these people are. I don't care if they know that I'm out on vacation, because they're not some random person that may try to find me or break into my house. I only want to know what people I actually interact with are up to. I don't care what 400 people that I don't know are up to. And every so many months, I go through it and I scrub it and I change it and I remove stuff. And if I haven't chatted with you in a while, it goes away. And so if you're not conscious of social media, it can super impact all different facets of your life very quickly. And so the first part is just being conscious of the amount of time you're on there and see if that's something that you can cut back. The second big theme he talks about is the decline of free play. So let's go on to that. And what does that mean? So he talks about declining free play, or this unstructured play in children's lives, and how it's actually impacting mental health. You know, remember when kids used to play outside until the streetlights came on? Like, that was kind of the rule. When the streetlights came on, you had to be back home, and there were no cell phones and no trackers and nobody knew where you were. And those days are long gone at this point. But what the author talks about is that free play is crucial for developing a couple of key things that you're going to need later in life: resilience, problem-solving skills, and social competence. So here's a quote that he says from the book: when we remove the opportunity for kids to engage in unsupervised play, we take away their chance to learn how to cope with risk and uncertainty. When you are always hovering and that child has no ability to develop resilience when things don't go wrong, or problem-solving skills when they get in a jam, what you're doing is you're taking away their confidence in themselves to say, when I'm older and I have a risky or an uncertain situation, I know I can handle it. Versus, oh my gosh, I can't handle anything. I need to call somebody. And that's a lot where the anxiety comes in. So he backs this up with data. He says that children who engage in more free play have lower levels of anxiety and depression. So here's the takeaway: encourage kids to have unstructured time where they can explore, take risks, and be kids. You know, growing up in my neighborhood, we would take our bikes after breakfast and head out. We'd stop somewhere for lunch or head home for lunch, and then we'd head out again, and there were no cell phones, no anything. Did we get into trouble or invent games? One of the favorites in my neighborhood was called Bleacher Tag. Yeah, and it was super dangerous. Bleacher tag is exactly what you think it is. It's a bunch of kids climbing and running up and down metal bleachers over a cement pad, even including the ladder that led up to the press box. Now, the press box wasn't open. You couldn't get in, but you could climb the ladder. And there would be at least one injury every summer. But that was something we did. We would go there and, you know, get onto the bleachers and run around, and somebody was it, and it was just fun. Was it dangerous? Yeah. Was it not great? Yeah. But part of it is going, you have to have those experiences. You have to have a little bit of danger. And we did it without adults hovering over us. And it helped us as kids, like, figure out how to play together. You know, part of it, when you think about it, when you let your kids go off or do some of these things, you're building trust. And we were trusted to figure it out. And a lot of that was because the parents in the neighborhood all worked. And so it was either an older sibling or a grandparent that, you know, tried to keep tabs on us, but they were kind of doing their own thing. So it's probably why so many in my generation have the, you know, quote, we'll handle it kind of attitude, because that's how we were raised. We were, you know, finding ways to entertain ourselves. We were told we had to figure it out. And the idea of this lost generation where they haven't had any of this exposure of risk, uncertainty, things they don't understand, having to solve a problem without calling a parent. So many of them experience that for the first time after they graduate high school. And a lot of us in the workplace, this is what we're seeing. Because we're going to have them try things and problem solve things and say, figure it out. And if they don't have the skills to do that, this is where the anxiety comes into play. The third lesson he talks about is this idea of safetyism, and he describes it as this overprotection of children. And the argument that he makes is that it's well-intentioned. It's an effort to try to keep kids safe from all harm. And it's that word all harm, that's actually contributing to their anxiety. And so in the book, he has a really powerful quote that stuck with me, and this is the quote, "When we prioritize safety over resilience, we inadvertently teach kids to see the world as a dangerous place and themselves as fragile beings." You know, that's a pretty heavy statement. So when you're always prioritizing safety over resilience, you're teaching kids that everything is scary and that they're not capable, if something happens to them, of coping with it. And so, you know, the word resilience, that one keeps popping up in a lot of books this season of the different books that I'm sharing. And there's a reason for that. It must mean something, right? When we as parents don't allow our kids to feel struggle, they don't get that sense of accomplishment when they work hard to achieve something. And in doing that, we miss a huge lesson that they need to learn. The lesson is that you don't have to be amazing day one. The lesson is you might have to work really hard at something you care about or something you don't. But if you work really hard and you can create a sense of mastery around that idea, you know that you can achieve things. You know that if you work hard, you can find a way to do great things and whatever that topic is. But you also know that you have to work through the struggles. You have to work through the challenges. And I think when people don't allow their kids to struggle or they go in and rescue them, you know, part of this book is around the idea of kids going, I did that. I worked hard at that. I worked hard at something I wasn't good at. I put in a bunch of time. It was struggling and challenging. I didn't like it. I got frustrated and I came out the other side. And so the author, you know, really shows data that the rise of this safetyism concept correlates with anxiety and decreased independence of young people. So as you were letting kids not go out, as they were always supervised, it's where the anxiety and this lack of independence comes in. So what's the lesson here? It's really a balance. You know, we need to find a balance between keeping kids safe and allowing them to experience life challenges so that they can build this resilience. What's the voice you're putting in your child's head? Is it the quote of like, I can figure this out? Or is it a quote of, I can work hard and do this? Or is it a quote, what if I get something wrong? What if I fail? What if my world ends because I don't have everything that's perfect? the things that you're asking and the questions and how you're phrasing the world becomes internalized for that kid. The verbal and the nonverbal signals you're sending, the questions you're asking, the areas where you're focusing, and the things you say become the voice in your kid's head. So what's the voice? What are you doing? So what can you do with this, right? Start small. Allow your kids to walk to school if it's safe. Let them handle conflicts on their own. Don't always need to jump in and solve their problems. You can go back to one of the previous episodes around leadership. You can ask questions as opposed to tell them what to do. Don't need to jump in. And let them know it's okay if it's hard, if there's a struggle, if there's a challenge. Tell them that that's how they learn and grow, is when they work through when it gets hard and keep going. The next key lesson is around this idea that you need pressure in order to achieve things. And so he talks about, you know, this pressure and is it the right type of pressure that you're putting on young people? Is it the pressure to go, I'm going to give you opportunities and I'm going to let you see the world and I want you to keep trying when it gets hard if it's something you're passionate about? Or is the pressure we're putting on people is the pressure to achieve academically, socially, and every extracurricular? And what he calls this is the achievement trap. And he says that that type of pressure, that pressure to achieve, is leading to burnout and anxiety. So he's got a really interesting quote where he said, we've created a culture where the value of a young person is measured by their accomplishments rather than their character or well-being. How often do you see this? You know, somebody who's a teen or in middle school and they've got a resume up the wazoo and that's what their parents talk about, as opposed to you're a good friend, you're a caring person, you're tenacious when something gets hard, you're willing to work through things. Are you talking about their character or are you talking about stats on a resume? And so what he does is he, you know, the author talks about studies that show that this constant pressure to achieve is leading to higher levels of stress and lower levels of overall happiness among teens. So these parents, the things that you're doing to go, oh my gosh, you have to do all these things, you have to be perfect, we have to do everything and get straight A's and all this stuff, it's creating so much stress that it's actually making them not enjoy these teen years. So what's the solution? You know, can you shift the focus from external achievements, which others have deemed important, right, the outside world, to internal growth and well-being? You know, by all measures, I should not have done as well as I have in my career, right? So let's just, like, look at that. I went to a public high school outside of Detroit. I was average academically by all measures. I often tell people that I was the dumbest kid in the smart kid classroom. So of the 35 or 40 kids that kind of took the advanced classes, I was like middle to the bottom of that group. I then went to college, had a 2.0, barely, first couple years. Got into the business school, which is something that wouldn't have happened today with a GPA like that. And my career wasn't linear. I tried different things. I tried, you know, different roles. I tried different companies before I found, you know, the role that I'm in now. And nothing in my teen years would have said that this would have happened now. There's nothing that you could have pointed to. There's no grade, no achievement that would have said, oh my gosh, she's going to get to this level in her career. No way. So what I often encourage when I speak at high schools, and I do this once a year at the local high school, is I said, you don't have to have it all figured out. And P.S., if you don't have a 4.0, you can still do awesome things if you find something you're passionate about and that you're good at. So maybe it's time that we take a step back and ask ourselves what truly matters. You know, instead of pushing for that next accolade or award, what if we encourage young people to just find joy in learning? Or creativity or self-discovery. You know, here's the funny thing. I once got asked what was the most important thing for my college years. And so it was a question that was asked of somebody that was about to graduate. And he's like, oh my gosh, you've been out of college. Like, what was the most important thing when you look back at your college years? It wasn't a class or finding my major or a great football team. It was meeting my husband. that choice in a partner shaped more of my life than anything else. And that's often not even in the mentions for what you would want to achieve in life, but probably the most important decision you'll ever make. The things that you're able to do and who you are as a person defines more of where you go than the stats on your resume. So let's talk about the last thing, which is this idea of building a culture of connection and support. So he talks a lot about connection in the book, and you know, the author emphasizes the importance of building strong, supportive relationships as a way to combat anxiety. And one of the quotes he has is, "At the end of the day, what protects us from the storms of life is our connections to others." He highlights research that people with strong social networks or strong connections are more resilient to stress and actually have better mental health. So in a world that's increasingly disconnected, I would say disconnected because digital is not fully connected, fostering real, meaningful relationships in person are more important than ever. So I will be honest with you. I don't understand Snapchats and constant texting as a form of connection. I text back and forth with people like a couple of times or something come up and then I'm like, let's grab dinner. Because I don't do well. I could not have a full relationship with somebody where my day is spent texting back and forth with them. I don't believe true connections are formed through electronic channels. And I think for many young people, you know, there's been stats that they'll say, well, I'll just leave or I'll do something else if something else better comes up. And it's this idea of there are no strong relationships. They don't know how to create really strong relationships or bonded relationships. And so everything is transactional. Everything is about social status. Everything is like, if something better, a better party, a better group, I'm going to leave what I'm doing and go to that group. You know, for me, I can't imagine having to sort, swipe, meet people online, especially for romantic interactions. I'm glad that wasn't a thing when I was coming up. But even if you do, the idea of like one or two conversations and then meet in person, right? And that's viewed as scary. That's viewed as overwhelming. But I think that that's the only way that you really form connections is through personal connections. So those are my five key learnings from the book. And it's really about rethinking social media. It's about encouraging free play and building those connections. It's changing the way that we think and the internal voices that we put in our kids' head. And the thing that he talks about is it's not too late to change things. So whether you're a parent, a teacher, or someone who's just curious about it, you know, there are a lot of things that you can do to make these changes that you would start to see right away. So thanks for tuning in to this episode of Curious KDO. I hope you found it insightful. I hope you found it interesting. And if you do enjoy it, don't forget to subscribe and share it with your friends. I'd love to keep this conversation going because I think together we can take some of these ideas and really make a difference. So until next time, stay curious.